here on VOA1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Katie Weaver has a report on the flying objects the U.S. military recently shot down over North America. Later, John Russell presents this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
U.S. military jets shot down three more flying objects over North America since taking down a Chinese spy balloon on February 4th. General Glenn Van Herk is head of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD. The command is responsible for protecting the airspace over the United States and Canada. Van Herk told reporters that the military has not been able to identify what the three most recent objects are, how they stay in the air, or where they are coming from. "We're calling them objects, not balloons, for a reason," Van Herk said. He added that part of the reason for the repeated military actions is a state of heightened alert. The state of increased readiness follows the incident of the spy balloon from China that entered U.S. and Canadian airspace. Since then, fighter jets have shot down three unidentified objects over 3 days. U.S. military officials say they presented no security threats, but so little was known about them that they were ruling nothing out. Last Friday, a U.S. fighter jet shot down an object about the size of a small car off the coast of northeastern Alaska. The unidentified object was flying at 12,000 meters, posing a risk to civilian air traffic. "We don't know who owns this object," said White House spokesman John Kirby. He added that it was unclear where the object came from. One day later, American and Canadian officials ordered a U.S. fighter plane to shoot down an unidentified cylindrical object over Canada's Yukon Territory. Canadian officials did not call it a balloon. They said it was smaller than the Chinese balloon shot down off South Carolina's coast a week ago, although it was similar in appearance. On Sunday, another U.S. jet shot down an octagonal object over Lake Huron on the U.S.-Canada border. Although it did not present a military threat, the object could interfere with civilian air traffic as it was traveling at 6,100 meters. Brigadier General Patrick Ryder, the U.S. military spokesman, added that the object might have had surveillance abilities. The U.S. defense officials said that the object was believed to be the same as one recently observed over Montana near sensitive military areas. The Montana incident led to the closure of U.S. airspace. All three objects were much smaller in size, different in appearance, and flew at lower altitudes than the suspected Chinese spy balloon shot down over the Atlantic Ocean. Melissa Dalton is the U.S. Assistant Defense Secretary for Homeland Defense. She said, "We have been more closely scrutinizing our airspace at these altitudes, including radar, which may at least partly explain the increase." China has denied its balloons were being used for spying. Chinese officials said the airship recently shot down was a weather balloon used for research. But the U.S. said the balloon contained high-technology equipment designed to gather information. Officials added that it was part of a military-linked surveillance program that targeted over 40 countries around the world. Japan recently said flying objects like the one shot down by the U.S. have been seen at least two times over northern Japan since 2020. In Taiwan, local media have reported that mysterious white balloons have been seen over the island at least three times in the past 2 years. And China described another balloon recently spotted over Latin America as a civilian airship used for research. I'm Katie Weaver.
Ice baths are a popular subject on American social media pages. Kim Kardashian, Harry Styles, Kristen Bell, Lizzo, and other stars have posted about their cold water experiences. Health claims surrounding ice baths include improved mood, increased energy, weight loss, and reduced inflammation. But the science linked to some of those claims is not very strong. Here is what medical evidence, experts, and fans say about cold water baths, an activity that dates back hundreds of years. Since June 2020, Dan O'Connor has jumped into Lake Michigan almost daily. The 55-year-old man lives in the city of Chicago. O'Connor used the term endorphins, feel-good hormones released in reaction to pain, stress, exercise, and other activities, to talk about his experience. The endorphin rush is an incredible way to wake up and just kind of shock the body and get the engine going, he said on a recent morning when the air temperature was -5 degrees Celsius. With the lake temperature at 1 degree Celsius, O'Connor did a running jump into the icy gray water. His first jump came early in the pandemic. O'Connor had too much alcohol, and his wife was angry at him. She told him to go jump in the lake. The common saying is not usually received as a real command. But O'Connor acted on it. He says the water felt good that June day, so he kept jumping in every day following. As the water grew colder with seasonal change, the good effect was even greater, he said. My mental health is a lot stronger, a lot brighter. I found some zen down here coming down and jumping into the lake and shocking that body, O'Connor said. Dr. Will Cronenwet of Northwestern University's Feinberg Medical School tried cold water immersion once while visiting Scandinavian friends. After a sauna, he jumped into the ice-cold water for a few minutes. He said it was a powerful experience. But Cronenwet says studying cold water immersion with a kind of scientific study, known as a randomized control trial, is difficult. This is because it is hard to develop a placebo for cold water baths. A placebo is something that has no effect. Placebos are important because scientific tests need to compare the possible effect of something with something else that does not have any physical effect. There are a few ideas about how cold water immersion affects the mind. Cronenwett says it makes the part of the nervous system that controls the resting state more active. Such an effect may increase feelings of well-being. Cold water immersion also affects the part of the nervous system that controls the fight-or-flight stress reaction. Cold water treatment on a usual basis may reduce that reaction. So, Cronenwett said, it might help people feel better able to deal with other stresses in their lives, although that is not proven. Czech researchers found that cold water immersion can increase blood levels of dopamine, another hormone, by 250%. High amounts have been linked with paranoia and aggression, noted James Mercer of the Arctic University of Norway. Mercer co-wrote a recent scientific paper that examined studies on the treatment. Cold water immersion raises blood pressure and increases stress on the heart. Studies have shown this is safe for healthy people, and the effects are only temporary. But sometimes these effects can cause the heart to beat unevenly and can cause death, Cronenwett said. People with heart conditions or a family history of early heart disease should talk with a doctor before doing cold water immersion, he said. Repeated cold water immersions during colder seasons have been shown to improve how the body reacts to insulin, a hormone that controls blood sugar levels, Mercer noted. This might help reduce the risk of getting diabetes. It also might help people with the disease control it. More study is required to know for sure. Cold water immersion also activates brown fat. This tissue helps keep the body warm and helps it control blood sugar and insulin levels. It also helps the body burn calories. I'm John Russell.
You just heard this week's Health and Lifestyle Report, presented by John Russell. Before we talk with John about his story, here is one quiz question for you to try to answer. What does the story say about heart conditions and cold water immersion? A. People who have heart conditions should try cold water immersion for small amounts of time, or B. People who have heart conditions should talk with a doctor before trying cold water immersion. The answer is B. You can find more questions about John's report on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now, John joins me to talk more about the story. Hi, John.
Hi, Ashley. Thanks for having me on the show.
In your report, Dr. Will Cronenwett said that cold water immersion is difficult to study through what is known as a randomized controlled trial. Can you talk more about that point?
Sure. Randomized controlled trials are considered one of the best kinds of studies to show that something such as a drug or treatment has an effect. In randomized controlled trials, participants are put into the test group or the comparison group at random, without a particular plan or method. It is also important that the participants do not know which group they are in.
And the comparison group often gets a placebo, right?
That's right. When scientists test drugs, the placebo is easy to develop. So for a drug that comes in a pill form, the comparison group can get a placebo that looks like a pill but does not have any active ingredients. But if scientists want to test cold water immersion, it is difficult to make the placebo for the comparison group. It is hard to make someone think they are getting in cold water when they are not.
I understand now why it would be hard to study some of the health claims about cold water immersion with a randomized controlled trial. Thanks again, John, for taking the time to talk with us today.
You're welcome. See you next time.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the presidential election of 1888, one issue that played a major part was tariffs. At that time, import taxes were high on many products. The high tariffs protected American goods from competing with lower-priced foreign imports. The tariffs protected millions of jobs in American industry. Not everyone, however, supported high tariffs. The President of the United States, Grover Cleveland, decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get the tariffs reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of business people. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. Shirley Griffith and Ray Freeman tell about the presidential election of 1888.
President Cleveland believed that high tariffs hurt more Americans than they protected. High tariffs, he said, led to high prices on all products. He also opposed high tariffs because they brought in more money than the government needed. The extra money was kept in the public treasury, and this, Cleveland believed, slowed the American economy. The president's Democratic Party united to support his policy of lowering tariffs. When the party held its presidential nominating convention in 1888, delegates quickly renominated Cleveland.
At the Republican Party convention, delegates were expected to nominate Senator James Blaine. Blaine had been the party's candidate 4 years earlier. He had lost to Cleveland in a very close election. Senator Blaine publicly criticized the president's policy on tariffs. He said he looked forward to a full debate on the issue. Republicans thought this meant that Blaine wanted to be nominated for president again. They told him he was sure to win. They said it would be such an easy victory that he would not have to campaign.
In fact, Blaine did not want the nomination. he asked that his name not be put before the convention. He met with reporters to talk about his decision. He said, "A man who has once been the candidate of his party and defeated owes it to his party not to be a candidate again." Many Republicans refused to accept Blaine's decision. They felt that if Blaine were nominated, he would run. Blaine replied, "If the presidential nomination is offered to me, I could not and would not accept it." That was final. Blaine's supporters had to find someone else to nominate for president.
Fourteen men declared themselves to be candidates for the Republican nomination. A leading candidate was Senator John Sherman of Ohio. Another was former Senator Benjamin Harrison of Indiana. Convention delegates voted several times. No man received enough votes to win the nomination. Then a message came from James Blaine. It said, "Nominate Harrison." On the eighth vote, the delegates did. Benjamin Harrison was the grandson of the ninth President of the United States, William Henry Harrison. Benjamin was a lawyer. He had been a general in the Union Army during America's Civil War of the 1860s.
After nominating Harrison, the Republicans approved a strong policy statement on the tariff question. The statement said, "We fully support the American system of protection. President Cleveland and his party serve the interests of Europe. We would support the interests of America. We would see all other taxes ended before we surrender any part of the protective tariff system."
Benjamin Harrison's campaign was well organized. His campaign workers went to businessmen who had become rich because of high protective tariffs. They asked for support, and the businessmen gave millions of dollars to the campaign. The businessmen also put pressure on the people who worked for them. They warned workers that if Cleveland were reelected, there might be no more jobs. Republican Party leaders took an active part in the campaign of 1888. They made speeches and led parades across the country. The party also printed millions of pamphlets that warned against what it called Cleveland's free trade policies.
Grover Cleveland's campaign was not well organized. It started slowly. It did not raise much money. No effort was made to answer Republican attacks on the tariff issue. And the president himself refused to campaign. He said he had more important things to do. The Democrats also failed to stop the Republicans from buying votes on Election Day. In Indiana, for example, men were paid $15 to vote for the Republican candidate. The Democrats bought votes too, but they had less money to spend than the Republicans. When the popular votes were counted, Cleveland had about 100,000 more than Harrison. But Harrison had more electoral votes. He won the election.
Grover Cleveland had mixed feelings about his defeat. He wanted to win because he believed his policies were best for the country. He said he was not sorry that he had made tariffs the major issue in the campaign. "I do not regret it," he said. "It is better to be defeated battling for an honest idea than to win by a cowardly trick." When President Cleveland and his wife left the White House, Mrs. Cleveland said goodbye to the servants. She told one of them, "I want you to take good care of all the furniture and other things in the house. I want to find everything the same when we come back 4 years from now."
The new president, Benjamin Harrison, had big political debts to repay. He understood this when he began organizing his administration. "When I came to power," Harrison said, "I found that my party's leaders had taken all the power for themselves. I could not name my own cabinet. They had sold every cabinet position to pay for the election."
The position of Secretary of State went to James Blaine, who had refused his party's requests to run for president. Blaine had served as Secretary of State under Presidents James Garfield and Chester Arthur. The position of Postmaster General went to John Wanamaker. Wanamaker had raised most of the money for Harrison's campaign. He had given $50,000 of his own money. He planned to repay party supporters with jobs in the post office department.
During the campaign, Harrison had promised to enforce the civil service law that protected the job rights of government workers. He promised that workers would be removed only in the interests of better government. Wanamaker and other party leaders criticized Harrison. They said they could not build a strong party organization without promising government jobs to voters. So President Harrison suspended the civil service laws that protected postal workers. Within a year, 30,000 Democrats were removed from the department. Their jobs went to Republicans. The president then announced that the post office would once again be protected by the civil service laws.
Former President Cleveland had been troubled by the extra money in the federal treasury. This was tax money the government collected, but did not use. Most of the extra money came from high protective tariffs on imported products. Cleveland wanted to reduce the surplus by reducing the tariffs. President Harrison decided to reduce the surplus too, but he would do it by increasing government spending, not by cutting taxes. Congress agreed. It became the first Congress to spend $1,000 million.
Much of the money was spent on payments to men who had fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. These payments cost the government more than $100 million a year. Congress also approved millions of dollars for government projects in the home states of important congressmen. This was called pork barrel spending. It paid for new roads, bridges, and government buildings, for almost anything the congressman wanted. Congress reduced the surplus even more by approving money to build coastal defenses and to buy warships for the Navy.
The American Congress passed several historic pieces of legislation during Benjamin Harrison's administration.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.